Good afternoon, everyone. It's kind of great to see you here today. Welcome. Often in life, there's more to see than first meets the eye, right? In lots of different situations, would we agree? There's more to see than what first meets the eye. So take, for example, this picture. What do you see? Some of you have probably seen this before, but what is this a picture of? A rabbit? A duck? Who sees a rabbit and a duck? Yeah, so sometimes, often, there's more to see than what meets the eye. Or how about this second picture? What do you see in this picture? Slightly more complicated, this one. Picture of a man's face. Does everyone see a picture of a man's face? Does anyone see anything else? An old man, a lady. How many faces do you see in this picture?
Three.
Three? Any advance on three? Four. If you, yeah, you can count the dog. Yep. Apparently, there are nine faces in this picture. I've had more time than you to look at it. I managed to find eight. I couldn't find the ninth one, but I could find eight. But apparently there are nine faces in this picture. Often in life, there's more to see than what first meets the eye. And these are just two very simple examples that I've lifted from the internet to try to help to illustrate this. And actually, as we've been discovering, as we've been looking together at John's gospel, often it's no different when we turn to the Bible. Often when we turn to the Bible, there's more to see in any particular passage of the Bible than what first meets the eye. This term as one church meeting across three communities, we're doing a series based on John's gospel, one of the four gospels found in the New Testament called Believe and Live. And during the first half of this series, we're looking in turn at each of the seven miraculous signs performed by Jesus that John records in his gospel, that he records to show us who Jesus really is. Signs that John tells us he's written about, John 20, 31, so that we might believe and go on believing that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing we might also have life, life in his name. And so here in our North community, Luke helped us look at the first of those seven signs a month ago. Today, we're going to be looking at the fourth sign. If you missed the talks on the second and third signs and would like to catch up, you'll find both of them on our church website or YouTube channel. But often in life and in the Bible, then there's more to see than what first meets the eye. So how is this the case with this fourth sign, or the fourth of these seven signs found in John's gospel? Well, let's read about the sign in question. That would seem like a good place to start. And if you have a Bible and would like to turn to it, it's found in John 6, but the words will also come up on the screen. And I'm simply going to read the first 15 verses. And whether you've been coming to church for years, whether this is your first time in church, this is a familiar story that most of us will have heard before. So John chapter 6, starting at verse 1, says this: "Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is, the Sea of Tiberias, and a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the signs he had performed by healing those who were ill. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover festival was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming towards him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "It would take more than half a year's wages to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up, "Here is a boy with five small barley loaves and two small fish. But how far will they go among so many?" Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and they sat down. About 5,000 men were there. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. Let's just pray. Heavenly Father, I want to thank you for your word. I want to thank you that your word is alive, that your word speaks to us today. And so as we consider these verses for this short time this afternoon, Heavenly Father, instruct our minds, inspire our hearts, and ignite our spirits, I pray, for the sake and glory of your Son, Jesus. Amen. Amen. There's a song we sometimes sing in church called "God, I Look to You." Lots of you, I'm sure, are familiar with it, yeah? "God, I look to you. I won't be overwhelmed. Give me vision to see things like you do." Yeah? Well, the story behind that song is that Jen Johnston, the lady who wrote it, found herself one day in her car singing, "God, I look to you because I'm overwhelmed." And as she was singing that line to herself, she felt God speak to her and say, "Girl, if you keep singing that, you'll stay that way." And so what she sensed God was encouraging her to do was to sing, "God, I look to you, I won't be overwhelmed," rather than, "God, I look to you because I'm overwhelmed." In other words, she felt God was telling her to sing, to prophesy truth over herself, and the rest of that song actually took shape from that particular moment or experience that she had in her car. Well, at the start of John chapter 6, both Jesus and the disciples have every reason to feel overwhelmed. And part of what I think John wants anyone who reads his gospel to see from these verses I've just read is that whilst the disciples, amid their feelings of being overwhelmed, see everything that unfolds around them one way, Jesus, who also has every reason to feel overwhelmed, sees everything completely differently. And so we have in this story this contrast between how Jesus sees everything and how the disciples see everything. And John wants to help us see just how different Jesus is to us. How different he is to whatever else or whoever else we might be tempted to look to rescue and to save us, especially when we feel overwhelmed. As that song by Jen Johnson puts it, John wants to give us vision or eyes to see things the way Jesus does. Here's three things from this sign that I think John wants to help us begin to see the way Jesus does. First, I think he wants to help us begin to see the crowds, how Jesus sees them. Second, I think he also wants to help us begin to see the glory and the goodness of God, how Jesus sees it. And thirdly, he wants to help us see ourselves, how Jesus sees us. So let's just take each of those three things in turn. First then, John wants to help us begin to see the crowds, how Jesus sees them. Now, before we go any further with this story, let's get this straight. This story, the feeding of the 5,000, should really be called something like the feeding of the 10,000 and many, many more. Yep. John highlights that there were 5,000 men present. He doesn't tell us or account in his account for all the women and children who were also, no doubt, there. And as we'll see, John is incredibly specific, I think, about the details he includes in his account of this story. Next, this is the only one of the seven signs recorded by John that is included in all four Gospels. John tends not to include signs found in the other Gospels. This sign and the next one, Jesus walking on water, are the only two exceptions. And so when John launches into recounting this sign with the word sometime after this, by which he means 6 months on from the end of chapter 5, what I think he expects us as his readers to do is to fill in the backstory from what we read in the other three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, who also tell this story. Now, that backstory, in short, is the disciples have just returned from a healing and preaching trip, and they are absolutely whacked, completely exhausted, while Jesus has just heard that John the Baptist has been beheaded. And so he's experiencing grief. Jesus and John the Baptist were related and generally considered to have either been first or second cousins. That's the backstory that John captures with these opening words, sometime after this. In the next few verses, John then refers to the crowd twice, and on both occasions, he draws our attention to this by describing it as a great crowd, a great crowd. I don't know if you've experienced this, but do you know how, if you're sending an iMessage on an iPhone, it now sometimes gives you the option of having the word bounce up and down within the actual message? Have you come across this? Yeah? Some people? It gives you the option. So like, I've come across it. If I type in the word yip, it gives me the option to have the word yip bounce up and down on the screen and on the other person's screen when they receive the message that I'm sending to them. Well, this is John's way of doing exactly the same thing, of highlighting a particular word, of drawing attention or emphasizing the word in question. Here, the word in question is the word crowd. So as you look at the screen just now, just imagine those two words, great crowd, just imagine that they're bouncing up and down on the screen in front of you as you look at them. Those are the two words from these opening verses that I think John most wants to draw our attention to. Great crowd. John wants to help us, as one writer puts it, see how Jesus faces the crowd, and he also makes his disciples and us face the crowd too. Now, John is less explicit about this than the other gospel writers, but nevertheless, he wants to confront us, I believe, with the crowds. In the same way, he tells us Jesus confronts Philip. If we turn to the other accounts of this sign, and particularly to Mark's account, what we discover is that for Jesus, Mark says, when he saw the crowd, Mark 6:34, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And the word that Mark uses for compassion has the meaning of gut-wrenching pity. Gut-wrenching pity. Jesus' stomach, in other words, is turned inside out for the people, for the great crowd he sees coming towards him as he sits on the mountainside. His compassion for them trumps every other need he feels in that moment. And so what does Jesus do? As he sees the crowd coming towards him, what does he do? Well, he starts healing and teaching them, or he spends time healing and teaching them. Now remember here, Jesus's need for space to process his grief is just as great as his disciples' need for space to recharge, following, by all accounts, their successful ministry trip. What we learn from the other accounts of this sign, though, is that it's not long before the disciples have had enough and want to send the crowd away. For them, the crowd is an intrusion into their private or personal space. Jesus sees the crowd differently because it's at this point, John tells us, he turns to Philip and asks, verse 5, where shall we buy bread for these people to eat? Can you see Jesus' care for people, even for their physical needs? Just in that question that he poses to Philip. As part of my work, I regularly have to facilitate training sessions where I take people through a simplified version of the different stages of grieving. We call it the grief journey. And when I do that, I often talk to the people I'm kind of training or facilitating training for. I talk to them about how sometimes when we experience grief, when we grieve, we need to delay our grief journeys. So for example, if you're caring for young children, or if you've been displaced and find yourself in a situation that isn't safe, then it's likely you're going to have to delay or park processing your own grief or loss temporarily, either for your own or somebody else's well-being. Does that make sense? Yeah? Well, here, Jesus, it seems, is prepared, not out of necessity, but because of his compassion, to delay his own grief journey, having just heard that John the Baptist had been beheaded. Such is his heart for people, the great crowd he sees coming towards him, people like you and me. His compassion overrides the pain of his own grief. And John wants us, I believe, to catch a glimpse of this for our own sakes and for the sake of those around us, especially those around us here in North Edinburgh. You know, to play our part in the mission of God to the north of this city, we need Jesus' heart. We need his compassion for the great crowd of people who live and work here and call this place their home. We can't just kind of engineer this for ourselves. We need his heart for the people around us. I've literally only just moved here, but as I walk and cycle around the part of North Edinburgh that God has placed me in, I am trying, because I know I need God's help with this. I'm trying to get into the habit of asking God to give me his heart for the people who live in the place where he has put me. Maybe you could do the same for the part of Edinburgh, north or otherwise, that God has placed you. John wants to help us begin to see the crowds as Jesus sees them. He wants us to begin to catch something of Jesus's heart for people. Second, John also wants to help us, I believe, begin to see the glory and goodness of God, how Jesus sees it. In fact, just as he's already been doing in his gospel, he wants to help us see that Jesus himself is the very embodiment of the glory and goodness of God. Luke spoke at length about the glory of God when he kicked this series off a month ago, so I'm not going to repeat what Luke said then, other than to reference again the occasion in the Old Testament found in Exodus 33 and 34, where Moses asks God to show him his glory, and God responds, "I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you." Whenever we see God's goodness, we are catching a glimpse of his glory. And all the more when we see his goodness in the person of Jesus. And that's what John wants us to see here, just like with the wedding at Cana, except here, first the disciples and then the crowd struggle to get it. John emphasizes this in how he tells the story. He tells us, firstly, in verse 6, that Jesus already had in mind what he was going to do. And so Jesus sees very clearly the generosity and goodness of God. But whereas the other gospel accounts of this story stress how far the crowd were from any shops, John tells us that Philip gets his calculator out and concludes that the catering bill is going to be too high for the occasion at hand. Andrew, the next disciple mentioned, fares a little better by finding the boy. But he likewise is too focused on what they need and don't have, rather than on the immeasurably more that's always possible because of the lavish generosity and goodness, the abundance that Luke mentioned earlier of the one they have in their very midst. Again, I think John emphasizes this difference between Jesus and the disciples by highlighting that the loaves and fish were small, even contrasting this tongue-in-cheek with the fact that there was plenty of grass. Plenty of grass. On top of this, he also adds that the bread was made of barley instead of wheat, meaning it was cheap bread, the food of the poor. And these are all details that are only included in John's account of this sign. You won't find those details in the other gospel accounts. The only person who comes anywhere near close to seeing the goodness of God as clearly as Jesus it does is the boy, who again John alone credits with providing the 5 loaves and 2 fish. The boy is the only person present who actually has no need of the lavish generosity of God in the moment. All he has to do is keep his lunchbox to himself. Right? So John uses his willingness, the boy's willingness to hand over his lunchbox to help us see we too have nothing to fear from entrusting our own limited resources to Jesus. Why? Because with Jesus, we have everything we need and more. With him, there's always more than enough. In fact, here, amazingly, there's even more left over than there was to start with, because Jesus himself wants us to see this. He wants us to see that he is our enough and so much more. This story is a rerun of the Israelites' journey through the wilderness, where for 40 years God miraculously provided manna, or bread from heaven, for his people. The Passover, the festival that John references in verse 4 was near, had been instituted during that time. And so John wants to help us see that Jesus is the reality, not only to which this sign points, Jesus is the reality to which the Passover itself pointed. All the goodness of God is found in him. Everything we'll ever need in any and every situation in life is found in Jesus, even when death itself comes knocking on our door. Because Jesus is the true bread of heaven upon which we are to feed, as this chapter goes on to explain in the discourse that makes up the large part of the rest of it. Later in this chapter, in John chapter 6, Jesus announces twice that he is the bread of life. Because just as God designed manna to require crushing in a mortar and to taste sweet, we are to fill our lives with the sweet taste of Christ's body, which was crushed for us on the cross at Calvary. We are to feed on him in our hearts, as we've already been doing this afternoon as we shared the bread and the wine together. Jesus has done everything necessary to secure our salvation and transform our destinies, as he himself explains to the same crowd later on in the chapter. They, however, don't get it. And so the question for us then is, do we? Faith that Jesus is our enough, and that he alone can satisfy the hunger in our hearts, is the main daily diet we all need. We all need to feed on him day by day by day. That's why there was new manna every morning when the Israelites were in the wilderness, to teach them that they needed to keep coming back to Jesus, or keep coming back to God day by day after day after day. Can I ask you this afternoon, have you grasped this? Do you know this yet? Do you know that Jesus is your enough? Do you know that you need to feed on him day by day by day? If not, we'd love to help you with that before you leave here today. We'd love to chat with you and pray with you. John wants you to see the goodness of God, how Jesus sees it, and he wants to help us see that Jesus himself is the very embodiment of the goodness of God, so that we recognize that Jesus is our enough and we come first and only to him to find what we need for our souls. So John, I believe, he wants to help us see the crowds, how Jesus sees them. He wants to help us see the goodness, the glory of God, how Jesus sees us. Finally, I think he wants to help us begin to see ourselves, how Jesus sees us. All of us, I'm sure, can see something of ourselves in the disciples. We're all generally more aware of our lack, of what we don't have, than of how in Jesus we have everything we could ever need. We're more aware of the limitations we see than of his ability to abundantly provide. And yet, the amazing thing I find with this story is that despite this, Jesus isn't deterred from inviting any of us to step into the story that he's writing, to give him what we have, just like the boy, and to give him who we are with all our blind spots and shortcomings, just as the disciples did, so that he can make it more than enough for what he wants to do in our own lives and in the lives of those around us. Notice how this plays out in this story, how Jesus doesn't just delegate the feeding of the crowd to the disciples and then leave them to get on with the task. Notice how even as he tests Philip, he doesn't say to him, "Where will you go to buy bread for these people to eat?" No, he says to him, "Where will we go?" Or, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" Jesus is inviting Philip, he's inviting his disciples to partner with him in the supernatural work of his kingdom. And Jesus is continually inviting us to do the same. He's always doing this. He's not put off by your shortcomings. He's not put off by my shortcomings. And he doesn't qualify us in the same way that we often tend to disqualify ourselves. John wants us to see this. He wants to use this sign to help us see ourselves as Jesus sees us. To reinforce what he's already been highlighting throughout his gospel up to this point, that Jesus is forever inviting us to partner with him in the supernatural work of his kingdom. And he's forever creating opportunities for us to do so. Just look at how Jesus' invitation to partner with him comes through in each of the seven signs that we've covered so far in this series. In John 2, at the wedding in Cana, Mary, the mother of Jesus, tells the servants to do whatever he tells you. John 2, verse 5. In John 4, again in Cana, the royal official, verse 50, tells us, took Jesus at his word. And his son in Capernaum instantly recovers from the life-threatening illness he was experiencing. In John 5, the man who lay crippled for 38 years, on Jesus' instruction, doesn't just lie there. No, he picks up his mat and walks. And here again in this sign, John provides yet more evidence of people partnering with Jesus in the work of his kingdom. And so John tells us that Jesus tells his disciples, verse 10, to make the people sit down. And the very next sentence makes it clear that that's what the disciples did. Then John tells us that Jesus tells the disciples, verse 12, to gather the pieces that are left over. And verse 13 confirms that that's precisely what they did. Jesus does what his Father tells him to do, and he's always inviting us to do the same, to partner with him in the supernatural work of his kingdom, even if we don't feel cut out for the task in hand. You know, it's never struck me before until I was preparing for today, but John doesn't actually tell us what Jesus gave thanks for in this story. I've always just assumed that Jesus was giving thanks for the loaves and the fish. And so this might be a little bit left field, but here's a thought. Could it be that Jesus doesn't just give thanks for the loaves and the fish? Could it be that he also gives thanks for the boy, for his simple faith and trust in him? Could it even be that he gives thanks for the disciples in that moment? We'll never know, but what I think we can be confident of is that Jesus is thankful for us when we bring the little we have to offer and place it in his hands. Whether that's the loaves and the fishes, as with the boy, or our willingness to do whatever he tells us, as with the disciples. And so John wants to help us see ourselves as Jesus does. He wants us to see our worth and our value to him. As I was preparing for this afternoon, I felt that perhaps for a number of us, maybe a good number of us, one of these three points that I've focused on would resonate with us more than the other two. And so what I'd love to do now, actually, I'd love to give us just an opportunity to respond by getting into groups of maybe three or four to pray for each other.